This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. During Pride Month, it's easy to forget that we are only a couple generations removed from laws that not only prevented gay and lesbian people from getting married, but also from socializing, from being out and proud. That doesn't mean that gay people didn't socialize. It just means that people and the places where they met risked more, much more. Here to talk about the history of gay bars in Michigan is Jillian Reese. She's curator with the Michigan History Center. Welcome back, Jillian.
Hi, good to talk to you again.
When do we see the first gay bars open in Michigan that were specifically geared toward a gay clientele?
So the years after World War II in the late 40s, 1950s, and 1960s, we start to see the emergence of an out gay nightlife. And we start to see not only bars that might be looking for new clientele to market to as a way to keep their business going, but we also see during that time period, gay people themselves opening their own bars and their own spaces to gather.
Were there places that gay men and women went to socialize and possibly drink before that time period?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think there were always places that people felt like they could go and be comfortable at. Sometimes these spaces were bars that had liquor licenses and, you know, were open to the public. Sometimes these were private clubs or even blind pigs, which are bars that operated outside of legality without liquor licenses. And, you know, they would be known spaces that queer people felt like they could go and gather together. These spaces tended to be divided by class and race up until the 1950s and 60s. Even life in Michigan was very divided by class and race. And it was pretty rare to have bars and public spaces that had a majority Black or Latino clientele. Most of those spaces were white. Black queer people tended to gather in private homes and have more intimate private parties within their community and not out in bars.
I find it really interesting that racism is so pervasive and has been for so long that it would even penetrate another marginalized group and community.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there are gay people and transgender people exist on every stratum of society. And a lot of times, you know, the things that connect them are really external factors and external discrimination, either from other people or from the state itself and from government itself. And so I think, you know, we really have to remember that, you know, a person who identifies as transgender or identifies as gay, you know, still have all the other things happening in their life. That's not necessarily the central thing of their identity. And so they are a product of the community that they grew up in. And, you know, the things like racism or classism play out differently, not only within the community, but how people are treated by the public. So, you know, when you go through particularly raids and arrests at gay bars, you can see this stark as day. If you were, let's say, a professional person, or you were white, or you were married, you might be arrested at a gay bar or as someone who was engaging in indecent activity, which was, you know, a euphemism for, you know, same-sex flirtation, you know, dressing effeminately, that sort of thing. You might be given probation or a warning because you were seen as someone who maybe just got off the wrong track or had one time slip up. But if you were someone who was poor or homeless or Black, you are given typically much harsher sentencing. You might be not only incarcerated, but put into a mental hospital for defects, because you are not seen as someone who was a one-time slip up. Your whole, your whole existence was a threat to society.
Your mental chemistry was off.
Exactly. And, you know, the way that that played into your life and the likelihood that you would have the harshest penalties really was determined by other factors like race and class.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jillian Reese. She's a curator with the Michigan History Center. Jillian, can you tell us about how the Michigan Liquor Control Act was used to regulate gay bars?
So after Prohibition in 1933, Michigan had to rewrite its liquor laws. And if you look at those liquor laws, they're very straightforward. They're basically saying, you know, things that we would consider today to be in the scope of liquor laws, that you had to label alcohol with the right percentage, that you couldn't, you know, open bars at a certain proximity to schools or churches. But as the years went on, we begin to see creeping in these sort of moral restrictions on the sale and use of alcohol. And by 1950, the Michigan Liquor Control Act had barred the sale of alcohol in any place that was known as a meeting place for homosexuals. And this is a change that, you know, I think researchers are still trying to understand. What I do know is that in the 1940s, there was a series of commissions that were enacted by the governor that were really focused on immorality in bars and how to get control of bars. And a lot of the language in these documents and these commission reports are around sort of the loose regulation of bars in Michigan and the need to regulate bars more because bars lead to deviant behavior. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the behaviors that they were sort of focusing in on was anything outside of the norm of, you know, a man and a woman in a marriage. So that behavior included homosexuality, but it also included a lot of very broad ideas of what improper, you know, sexual behavior would have been at the time.
That's interesting. It's kind of like a pinpointed prohibition.
Yes, exactly. And what it did was, at the same time that bars and public spaces are beginning to be important places for gay people to gather, and some of the only spaces in communities in some of these big cities like Detroit and smaller cities like Lansing or Flint, that these spaces were places that they could gather, but they also, just by being in those spaces, you were open to arrest. Hmm. You were also open to being outed, particularly gay bars that operated without licenses. Would sometimes be owned by organized crime or people who would find out that someone was gay and maybe had a good job and then would extort them and try and get them to pay the money in exchange for keeping their identity quiet. Oftentimes these raids, the names of the people in the raids would be published in the newspaper, which was a sort of an additional sentence beyond the sentence you might have been given, because your whole community would then know, okay, this is someone who is gay or transgender. And then depending on the way that they saw that, that they would react. So it oftentimes led to violence, death, loss of housing, loss of a job, because there was sort of this black and white evidence that this person was gay without any sort of behavior or activity, just just the being present at a gay bar was enough to lead to these sort of conclusions.
When did we see these raids sort of come to a conclusion or be outlawed?
So certainly raids on gay bars were much rarer in Michigan than in places like New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles. But they did happen, and we do have lots of evidence in court records that they happen. But these laws started to get repealed in the 1970s when people in Michigan began coming out politically as gay. So their experiences in these spaces and the way that folks were left vulnerable to some of these really dire consequences really rallied people together and got them to push to pass non-discrimination laws, to speak openly about the persecution that they were experiencing from particularly the police, and the way that they felt like police would target them whenever, you know, there became sort of this idea that we need to get tough on crime. And so you really see in Michigan some of the first non-discrimination laws in housing, in jobs that we've talked about before.
So, you know, earlier when we were talking about the racial divides in a lot of these bars and establishments, I wonder what the role was of drag queens and queer performers in bridging some of those racial divides.
If you were, let's say, going to a gay bar in the 1960s in places like Detroit, you would be seeing that drag performers that were both white and black. But drag and in the United States and its origins comes from African-American queer culture. So, you know, you might have a largely white clientele, but the performers, musicians, drag queens themselves tended to be black. And it was really one of the ways that these bars could integrate. Now, there's something to be said about having, you know, a white space where only black, what the only black people you are seeing is performing for folks.
Right.
But I also think that this was a way to start sort of breaking down those barriers. Now, those barriers are still in place. Many gay bars are still segregated by race. And, you know, even in a city like Detroit, you can walk into a gay bar and be an all-white space. That should be said. But at the same time, I do think that, you know, drag queens and the presence of drag queens and the veneration, really, of drag queens and in gay culture did offer that space within gay bars for Black queer people.
So where did we see the nexus of Black drag queens and queer drag queen culture emerge in Michigan?
So really, you know, the best known drag bars in Michigan, especially during the 1960s and early 70s, before we see another change sort of in drag culture and gay culture in America with the coming of AIDS and the lack of response to AIDS, Detroit and Flint were two places that had really visible drag culture. And not only would there be homegrown performers that would perform at these bars, but there are also advertisements for queens that were coming from New York and California and Atlanta and Washington, D.C., some of the biggest, still today, some of the biggest cities for American drag. And they were coming to Detroit and Flint to perform. Until the late 1970s and 80s, Lansing didn't really have a drag, quote-unquote, drag bar. Most of the time, from what I can understand, folks would have had to gone to Flint or to Detroit to see that sort of thing. And they did, when especially when bigger performers from the coast would come on tour.
What did the advertisement label these shows as, since they were sort of early in their inception?
they were called drag shows. You know, I think we have to remember in American culture, female impersonation is a really normal part of American theater.
Yeah.
From vaudeville to things like minstrel shows, there were always men impersonating women. Now, whether or not they were drag queens, that's a discussion for another time. But female impersonation was something that was brought to American audiences from, you know, the Civil War on. But in terms of specifically drag queens, you know, there was in the 50s and 60s a growing network among major American cities of performers who were going around and, you know, making money off of being a full-time drag queen. Something that we really don't consider a lot of times. We sort of think that period of drag was later. And when you read these advertisements, they're geared towards straight audiences. And when you read about, like, for an example, the State Bar, when they were moved out of their original location in Flint because of urban renewal, and the owner bought a larger bar, and it was specifically because she wanted to have these large drag shows. And you read the same sort of lamenting from the queer audiences saying that there are too many straight people at their drag shows, because it was very popular apparently to go to the State Bar on the weekends and see the drag performers. And, you know, that's again, something that we think is pretty modern, but was definitely something that queer folks were remarking about in the early 60s, when they were watching these shows.
Yes, gentrification and cultural appropriation are as American as apple pie, Jillian.
Yeah, and I think it's of two things. You know, I think it's a little bit of that fascination, you know, maybe gentrification and appropriation, but I also think that these spaces were spaces where could feel maybe a little more free, where sure, even if you weren't queer, that you could feel that acceptance from a community that, like I said before, comes from every walk of life, and that they're coming into this space to bring joy and have fun.
Jillian Reese is a curator with the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thank you so much.
Thanks.